Well, okay.
He's first chronologically also.
Okay. Hey,
coming out of the Gemara, right? Basically, the only witness we have, right, we have from the period of the Gaonim, says, right, seems to say, if we work on the assumption, which seems a reasonable assumption in Halachas Gedolos, that we are selecting out the halachic sections. So he quotes Rav Huna, and he does not quote Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua.
Right.
But he still quotes two of the stories at the end. Right, which means that he thinks the story of the Dikulai and the story of the Amrai are compatible with Rav Huna.
Well, the stories they're not.
Pardon? Both stories.
Yeah, there's no reason they're not compatible with both. I'm saying it's easier to say they're compatible with Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua, but there's no reason inherently to say they're not compatible with both.
Okay, so that's right. That's our question, right? Do we think? Do we interpret them in such a way as they are only compatible with Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua, or do we interpret them in a way that is compatible? That is compatible with Rav Huna. Now he has the same text Rav Huna that we have. He doesn't seem to have anything radical in his interpretation of the sugya, except he leaves out a couple of the conditions. He doesn't. Right. This one. Right. He leaves out the whole discussion of the Surah Derabanan. In essence. And he leaves out everything about Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua, including the things Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua says are pshita. Now maybe those are all kal v'chomer from Rav Huna. Okay, but that's our right. That's what we have starting off, right, which we can build whole theories about. Is he paskins like Rav Huna? Apparently, paskins like Rav Huna means he paskins against Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua. And that Rav Huna Brei Yeshua has nothing to add, best we can tell. And he quotes the two stories. He leaves out the section of the... He leaves out the statements dealing with Surah Mei Rabbanan and the story dealing with Surah Mei Rabbanan. There's a simple thesis about that, which is... the Lo Kilchasa. Right? Simple thesis about that. And he also does not cite any of the Braitot in the Sugya, or Mishnayot. I don't know how much significance to give to that. I don't know enough about the methodology of the Halacha Gedola about whether that is right, whether that's part of his general synthesis or not. Okay, then we had the Ravid as cited by the Shita L'Nodu L'Mi, as cited by the Shita Mekubetzet. Right, so we're playing telephone in a certain way. All right, and Ellie, how did you understand what the Ravid said?
I mean, we had trouble with it because, like, his like, we didn't really understand his point.
Uh huh. Okay.
I also like how exactly you translate the word "bukvul habera." It seems like a stickle ambiguous.
Good question. Shramachal, how did you understand it?
I don't know.
You don't know either? Oh, I didn't think it was the hardest thing in the world. It seems to have puzzled it. Anybody want to volunteer and explain?
Okay, that's the thing. Okay, fine. I don't know. He seems to think that it's Mistabro, that there's a second school, and he's the only person to ever brought up the second school so far.
Well, he mentioned. So you're assuming that Babi Gvul Chavero is a reference to Asagos Gvul, and it's Mistabro that it's. Well, how does Mistabro that Asagos Gvul doesn't resolve the question of Gemara ends in Tekus, right? We're trying to figure out what you do in a Teku case. Okay, Jenna, what do you want to say?
Maybe I'm not understanding what we're confused about. He's saying, like, we're at a Teku, so what do we do? Is that what he's saying? So then for him, what makes sense is because we're not sure, we, like, the safe side of things is to, like, let him stop him because he's the new guy is the one coming into someone else's boundary. And, like, so somehow he must see that's the, like, original offense is, like, coming into someone else's boundary, right?
Okay,
whereas,
so,
like, he's saying, the other side would say that the original offense is stopping someone from doing something. Does that make sense?
Okay. So the formulation, right, so you're right, certainly in part, and then I want to figure out if the formulation works. So we're saying, what we have is a teiku, and the challenge is, what do we do when there's a teiku? So... one possibility, which seemed to be what Sipar Malka was suggesting, is we take whichever side makes most sense, right? And that can just be, right, so we can just take Mistabra as meaning, we resolve a teku, whichever way makes sense. And the Mestaber is not saying this is what it seems we should do because this is a formal case of teku, and here's and this fits in the standard patterns of resolving tekus, but instead we pick whichever side makes sense. I doubt that's what it means, but I think that's what Sipar Mach was arguing, was it not?
Or maybe what he's saying is that...
Was that what you were arguing?
Not really.
Okay, so we'll take it as a straw man. Okay, the second possibility, which I think is more likely, is that he is somehow assimilating this case to the standard rules of how you resolve tekus. And so then, right, so then you introduce the new, right, and then there's a machloket about how the standard rules of teku, either about what the standard rules of teku are, or how to apply the standard rules of teku to this case. And you assume that there is an agreement about the standard rules of teku and introduce the notion called original offense. Right, so let's talk, right, so what is right, so that's the term that needs formulating. So what do you mean by original offense?
Well, but, so I wasn't meaning in the case of, like, in the general way of dealing with teku. I was saying, like, in this conversation that we're having. So I don't know how that would relate to, like,
uh-huh. In this conversation, so what made you introduce the word offense?
Because I couldn't think of something better. But, like, I guess it's kind of, like, where I was wanting to use status quo again. Like, if we were to do nothing, like, what would be okay?
Okay, so that's a different, right? That's a different concept, and I think status quo is probably a more interesting term when you figure out what breaches the status quo.
Right.
So what we want to say is that it seems reasonable that when you hit a teku, what you have to do is freeze.
Right.
The question is, what does it mean to freeze? So the Ravid says that we freeze everyone where they should be. Right? And he should not be here. Right. Okay. Yes, Josh. What do you want to add?
I think this is related to in Dini. I mean, I think in Dini Mamonot we have a rule that in every monetary dispute, one person is the muchzak, the person mm-hmm. who owns the status quo. The other person isn't. The other person to get anything has an affirmative standard of proof. Hamotzi mechaviro alav haraya. So you have to prove conclusively, based on the sugya, that you should be able to stop the person from moving in, or that you should be able to come in and take the other person's livelihood away. And so the question, I think this machloket is, who is the muchzak? Which I think is exactly the same thing that Jen is using. I'm just using Mamonot's language from Mamonot.
You want to use them? So we'll have to figure it out, because I think that is really the challenge, is that Hamotzi mecharei lo haraya is a right, but who is in possession of what, and what? Right, what is it we are discussing? I think that's a big part of it. Right, Sperma, what did you want to say?
I think maybe the Ravid is possibly like Yuvan against Tova from yesterday, and it believes that we already have regulations in place here. The other guy has no rights, so let's just keep let's go by the person who actually has rights in the space and keep him there.
That's exactly what I said.
That goes
that's actually what I said.
You framed it in terms of commercial rights, and he framed it in terms of the right to not have regulations.
No.
I heard backwards. No.
Maybe everyone should explain what they meant yesterday.
No.
I guess
no.
That's what they meant yesterday.
You talked about
okay.
about the goal being more and more regulations as against more and more public.
You had a really good formulation yesterday, and now it's all confused.
Yeah.
Elliot, what do you want to say?
So, I guess, to me, this isn't so much a thing as we freeze everything and we go by the status quo, but that we've seen earlier in this sugya, that we have this idea of not going to Gvul Chayo with, which is already with the Rav's case, and something we've already seen conflated in earlier Tzvivot HaGeonim, and therefore we see this concept here. Now we have a teku, let's go back to the earlier part of the sugya that this matches up with and say, no, you can't.
So you go back to Rav Huna Miteku.
Yes.
Since Rav Huna Bar Yehoshua can't make up his mind, so we have a sort of Bari Vashema. Interesting.
What?
Well, Rav Huna was sure, Rav Huna Bar Yehoshua was not. So let's pass it like Rav Huna.
Rav Huna's wrong.
Well, who's wrong about...
That's what people later on will say. Who
we can even say Rahuna's wrong about the thing that Rahuna Brave Yeshua was sure he was wrong about. Right? But now we're not sure he's wrong, right? So we might as well. Right? So unless you're sure he's wrong about this, let's go back to the first. Right? So that's an interesting argument. Hard to fit in the language, but interesting, right?
Well,
but
I
it's
guess,
doable.
I guess I was saying that because I saw the conflation of Huna's language and Gvul in Uli Geonid Kuvas from last week,
yes.
I said the language is the same here as well.
Yeah, you can. It's doable. Right? It's doable. Yes, Eli.
I just think the word Gvul is a very, very strong word because he didn't use the word Rishas or any of the Lashon of the Gemara. He said Gvul.
You know, I think that's absolutely right to be sensitive, and that's what Eliot's picking out also, that Babi Gvul Chavero is not a term from this sugya. Right? It's an importation.
From Hilchos Brachos.
From Hilchos Brachos?
From Esrei. Right? That's the Gemara's usage of Babi Gvul, that if I'm davening, right, if I'm sitting here, someone else starts davening, I don't have to bother, right? I don't have to get up and move away.
Uh-huh.
That's where the Lashon's taken from.
You think it's where it's taken from?
That's Lomdash, no.
Wait, how is it not an scene?
Pardon?
It's about location, isn't it? It doesn't seem weird to me, or maybe
I'm not
understanding
right,
location's location.
What it really means.
Yeah, it's just that it's not a term in the sugya. We at least at some point become accustomed to thinking of the category Hasagat Gvul as a metaphor for general economic relationships. Right? This is being introduced here. And it suggests that he has some kind of, that there's some kind of prior conception that he's assimilating this question too, which was along the lines of what you're all trying for. Okay, so I think if we were to try to narrow down what the machloket is, so the Ravid seems to feel that the other person entering the business is framed as, let's use it in Joshua's terms. When I set up my grindstone, so what is what I am doing exercising my rights? Now, if I'm exercising my rights, so then you should have to, right? You should have to prove that I don't have them. What am I doing is taking away someone else's space, in which case I should have to prove I have a right to do it. Right, so the question is our default setting that everyone has a right to everywhere? Right, and any time I limit you, I am being motzi from your right to be everywhere. Or is our default setting that everyone has a right to their space? Right, and if I want to enter your space, right, then I have to prove I have a right to. Right, so it could be there's a very fundamental machloket about how we conceive of the relationship, whether people fundamentally have spaces, or whether fundamentally we are all citizens of the world.
It's the fundamental question, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of like you could get at the heart of what we've been like.
Yes, if you
this whole packet, you could just go to each person and say, "What would you do with the teiku?" And then you'd know what their like fundamental assumption.
If they take it that broadly,
right?
Right. So this is a useful rishon because with the Ravid, all of a sudden the machloki can be framed in extremely broad terms. But you can also, starting from that, you can find much more minimalist versions where it's only limited to business, and it's only limited to businesses that relate to Parnassa, and it's all right, and so on and so forth. We can narrow it down. That's the broadest version. Toby, what do you want to say?
I think this is a very good proof of my reading.
Both ways? Both, everyone agrees with you. The only question is,
yeah.
Aha. All right.
It's all about property.
I can just reframe it. The question is, when we set public policy, do we wish to set right that we're right that we haven't proven anything, right?
Well,
all I have to do is put
that. We disagree. The point is that mine is a clear formulation of what you think.
Okay. Yes, Chaim. Why are we discarding Rav Huna? We haven't said yet why we're discarding Rav Huna. Right? Eliot wants to think we're not discarding Rav Huna. Right? Eliot argues that what we're doing is we're resurrecting Rav Huna. Right? The assumption.
The Ravid is resurrecting.
Right. The Ravid is resurrecting Rav Huna because he says once Rav Huna ben Yehoshua admits to uncertainty, right, we're going to get rid of Rav Huna ben Yehoshua and put Rav Huna back in. I think it could very well be that if we want to treat this as a deeply fundamental machloket, we can frame it that way. Of course, the Ravid is going to be unique. So, how much weight we can give on the Ravid, then we can have the whole Achi position which relates to last night. You know that the Ravid, you probably all know this with Dr. Soloveitchik, right? The Ravid is part of the whole lost halakhic continent of Provence. If you don't know this, right, the Ravid wrote a full commentary on Shas. He was the Talmudic commentator. It's all lost, except we have resurrected the Havasra and Avodah Zarah, and almost everything that belonged to the Ravid's halakhic culture disappears. And is, right, I get to say my favorite sentence in all of Judaic scholarship. The multiple panzer thrusts of Natan's intellect shattered the old simplistic interpretations, and under the quiet but relentless generalship of Rav Isaac of Dampier, the fields of the Talmud were organized, cultivated, and administered by Tosafist thought. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik.
Can you say it again?
Slower.
The multiple panzer thrusts of Rabbeinu Tam's intellect. You have to get the pun, right? Because what it is it, and it's an amazing chutzpah, right? Because it's panzers are right, a German World War II tanks. Rabbeinu Tam is German. And Rabbeinu Tam's intellectual armies are sweeping into southern France. No. It's Franco-Germany. Right? Right, so it's amazing to be willing to use an imagery, right? It's the Tosafistic blitzkrieg. The multiple panzer thrusts from Rabbeinu Tam's intellect shattered the old simplistic interpretations, and under the quiet but relentless generalship of Isaac of Dampierre of Rommel. The field.
Rommel? No.
Yeah, because
Rommel is panzer.
Rommel is a panzer. Who does the stuff behind?
Who does what?
You're right. Rommel has the panzer. Who's behind him? Whoever it is, right? Because the whole thesis is that you
Patton and Eisenhower.
Right. No. The whole thesis of the war strategy is you have these two entrenched armies facing each other, and normally you thought you had to push the front line back. That was your strategy. And instead, what tank warfare introduced is you could just break through the lines at one point and then just turn right and then turn around and the other army would have to retreat. His position was indefensible anymore once you got behind them, right? So first you have the panzer thrust breakthrough, and now the position of the Ravid's positions are indefensible, and now the Rav Isaac of Dampier can walk through systematically and reinterpret all the places where the Rabbeinu Tam didn't specifically knock out the Ravid, right? Once Rabbeinu Tam got through, it was all over. Right, under the quiet but relentless generalship of Isaac of Dampier, the fields of the Talmud were, I always forget the order of the verb, but right, either organized and cultivated or cultivated and organized and administered by Tosafist thought. The story about this is that Professor Berger assigned the article. I think it's three themes in Sefer Chassidim. And during, when I had undergraduate finals, I think, so I hadn't like slept in 3 days when I walked into class, and it wasn't at all sure, I read all this in a fog, and I think he asked, like, so what does Professor Soloveitchik say? I just had so loved that sentence that I was in a fog. I just memorized that sentence. It was always extra credit in GAN on all my tests if you could write that sentence from memory. Okay, yes. Pramapli, you want to say something? Okay. So there's the Ravid. And whole ongoing question history of Halakha as we recover Provence Halakhic culture. What weight does it have halakhically, since basically it lost? It wasn't around to be copied by the time you get to the Shulchan Aruch.
For a reason, right? Meaning, it didn't lose because it wasn't around. It wasn't around because it lost.
It lost because Rabbeinu Tam won.
Right.
And the Tosafists won.
But people wanted to learn Tosafists.
Yeah.
Shot them more than that.
So that's true. Just like, you know.
Isn't it a good thing that the Rebbe of the Arizal collect all this stuff?
The closest analogy we have now is to non-Brisker Lumdus from the 19th century. You could wander through tons of yeshivot in the 20th century, and you would never have heard of many of the 19th century figures. And it might be, if it weren't for Hasidus, if the only culture that won were Lithuania, so then the Chiddush Harim would just vanish. And then 100 years later, people would say, oh my goodness, you know, we've done everything we can do in this method. Or 500 years later, look, there's this incredible person, the Chiddush Harim. Look at this amazing stuff. Nobody thinks that way nowadays. Let's recover him. Right, that's right. In the Lithuanian world, the Chiddush Harim is the Ravid. You know, there are a few words that are quoted here and there. Right, no one actually reads it. Dr. Soloveitchik argued that Rekiv Eger is the same way. Except all that's left is the Gilyonos, and nobody reads the Drish V'Chiddush. So you learned the culture is when he got up at a lecture and he challenged, you know, has anyone here ever read through a full Drush V'Chiddush? And Eli Baruch Shulman was in the audience. All of it. Yeah. What are you talking about? Much fun.
I'd compare him to Lil Bush, meaning he's quoted, but like no one cares, because we never hold with him. Because he's just rejected.
That's a question, but Bush doesn't have a culture behind him. Bush is an individual figure. Right? But he has a whole culture. He is the greatest, right? People say, right?
Lil Bush had Tom Edom, who liked him, so he'd also
have the right is Gedolah HaMefarshim in the Neri.
Yes, that's how Dr. Soloveitchik's big proof. The Rebbe is Gedolah HaMefarshim.
But what's weird is that's one of Dr. Soloveitchik's knocks against Professor Dvorsky is, oh, you keep pointing to the Neri, calls him Gedolah HaMefarshim, but that's inconsistent. That's not a good reason.
I don't think so. I think that's one of his points, is that he thinks Professor Tversky builds his picture of the Ravid on the Hasagos, and that's incorrect, that because the Hasagos are just stuff he dashed off in the middle of the night.
No, it's that Professor Tversky refers to the use, the Miri's use of Gedolah HaMefarshim as a proof for him being Gedolah HaMefarshim, and not actually investigating it through the actual pair, through the pair chain.
I don't remember that. I don't know. I thought it was the other route, but any case. So we have this Ravid, and it may be that the Ravid has a... It seems clear, right? However radically you want to read the Ravid, that if, in fact, Rov HaPoskim Chokolov really means Kol HaPoskim Kulam, that the Ravid has a completely... Right, it's possible the Ravid has a different conception of Tekuv, but it's much more likely the Ravid has a completely different conception of the Sugya, and one that can really... That can really open up worlds. Possibly based... You know, and we could then strengthen that by saying it's really based on a very strong notion of Hasagas Gvul, that the Ravid really believes there is such a thing as private, very very strong sense of private space that isn't shared by others. Okay, turning the page. So now we have the Gilyon Tosa, whatever that is. Yes, you know.
I would ask: do you think it's possible to read Rav Huna Beder of Yeshua as agreeing with Rav Huna?
Yes, I do.
That would explain both the halacha of Gedolah and the Ravid.
Yes, it is possible that they don't see it as a machloket.
Meaning, if Rav Huna, if when Rav Huna says Bar Mavoa Chavre, he really means Bar Mavoa Achrine. If Chavre means Achrine, then it all makes sense.
Okay. I am over here. I don't know anyone directly on the sugya who says that explicitly, but I think that option needs to be held open. Absolutely, the challenge to that is the term muda later in the sugya, which seems to suggest that there must be some kind of machloket. So you have to figure out who the machloket is with.
The
Modi Rav Huna. Yeah, Modi Rav Huna, Modi Rav Huna, yeah. But also part of the question is whether when you have two characters in a sugya, both of whom are named Huna, confusion arises. Yes, Chaim?
The second Mudah is Shver, even if you don't say that they're agreeing with each other.
True. I'm happy to collect problems at this stage. I really am. Yes, Ellie?
Is this strange lesson of like, Teku and then Mustavra?
I don't know.
It's just seems like very strange that the Gemara isn't Teku, it's like Mustavra, that it shouldn't be clear in any way.
I agree. It's an odd language. It is odd language. All right. Okay, so then we get to the Gilyon Tosa Shidukibesis. The Gilyon says that, the Gemara says that there is a machlok, that the position of Rav Huna is actually subject to a machlokas tanoim. And this astonishes the Rashba, who is not the Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, the student of Ramban. But I always forget who it really is.
Rashbi Shantz
consistently? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, okay, excellent. So, Avi, how did you understand his question, his problem?
It seems like his problem is, why do they bring this Breita and not the earlier Breita?
Which Breita?
Why do they bring the Breita
They bring the Breita in which the Machloket is whether you can be Kofesh Chenato.
Yes, and why did they not bring the one with Rabbi
Bitter Rabbah? Okay, we had an earlier Breita. An earlier Breita which is about whether you can be...
Whether you can give out candies to children.
So if we're going to claim that Rav Huna is one side of a... Right, and really, at this point in the sugya, right, why do we say Tanahi? Because we have a Kushya. We have found a Breita that disagrees with Rav Huna. So if we found a bride that disagrees with the Rifuna, we'll say, "Why? What's the problem? We already saw, right? We saw a bride that agrees with the Rifuna, or at least a position in a bride that agrees with the Rifuna. Why do we need a new bride?"
Yeah. Okay. Now let's remember what the Gemara tried to quote that earlier bride, and the Gemara tried to set it up as Tanoi also, right? The Gemara said, "Lema misay." Well, actually, how did the Gemara introduce the bride of the Chen Vani? What was the Gemara's introduction? What's the term? Okay, so we have it, right. So this was actually done as an earlier source, and remember that was also a kusha, right? So the first attempt to knock out Rav Huna was a claim that Rav Huna only holds like Rav Yehuda and not like the Rabbanan, but the presumption is Rav Huna holds at least like Rav Yehuda. And then we say, maybe he doesn't only hold like Rabbi Yehuda, maybe even the Rabbanan can agree with him.
Yes.
Right? So when we let, at this point in the sugya, that earlier Breita has one position that definitely supports Rabbi Huna and one position that might or might not. So here, the Rav Shans comes in and says, so if we had at least one position that supported Rabbi Huna, right, what's the kushya? Let's put that one. And the answer is?
The answer is that there is a difference between giving out sweets, and which is Aser Kohen Rabbi Yehuda, and Yorei Lomelech Leiro, which is an entire Kohen Rabbi Yehuda.
So let's, before we get to the substance, structurally, what's the solution? The solution is that maybe, right, so we first, right, Ravina says, in that Braita, Rav Huna holds like Rav Yehuda, not the Rabbanan. The Gemara says, no, maybe even the Rabbanan can hold like Rav Yehuda. And the Rashi Shan says, no, maybe
even
Rav Yehuda disagrees with Rav Huna.
Yeah.
Right, so we've gone through three options, and the teretz he gives is fundamentally against the structure of the Gemara. Right, because the Gemara concludes that Rav Huna is compatible with both positions, and he now says, well, maybe, but the Gemara is thinking in its head, and maybe it's incompatible with both positions, and in the end, right, he says, in the end, we can say that Breita is irrelevant to Rav Huna. Right, we can say that both positions support Rav Huna. We can say that both, right, and he now thinks that we can say that both positions oppose Rav Huna. Which ends, now, the way we said that both positions can agree with Rav Huna was by saying that the Machloket, when saying that Rav Huna says that you can prevent kind of competition A, and that's unfair competition, and there's a machloket about whether you can prevent even fair competition. Right, that was our issue. So now we're going to have to say, what?
This is the unfair competition.
And everyone agrees you can prevent.
Everyone agrees you can prevent someone.
Right, remember, we're going to say that both positions of this breita.
Everyone agrees that you can.
Everyone agrees that you cannot prevent someone from opening up a new grindstone.
Yes, what you can prevent, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is to give out sweets to children.
Right, so now why is that? Why would I think that you can open up a grindstone, right, next to another person's grindstone, but you can't give out sweets?
Competition is fine, and cheating is not.
So this is, right, so now we have to claim that the distinction is not between fair and unfair competition, because we've decided that the Rechayim is, in fact, fair competition. This is something else entirely. So what is it? You call it cheating. Why is it cheating?
One way to call it cheating is that I am using a trick to take custom away from my competition by giving treats to agents that have no die.
Okay. So one way to do it is to focus on the children. Right, they claim that this is cheating. Or the way I phrase it more sharply is that it's introducing a distinction between the interests of the principal and the interests of the agent.
Also.
Pardon?
The thing that I added is that it's also a bad agent.
And it's also an agent who's highly susceptible to such distinctions. Okay, so that's where I think we're at something along those lines. We're gonna have to claim that there is something unique about the case of Klayot Ve'Egozim, which has nothing whatever to do with a general issue of competition. On the general issue of competition, everyone, he says, rejects Rav Huna, and says that, right, that so far as we know at this point, right, there are no restrictions on competition at all. Okay, yes, Avinu.
So
So Avi's explanation ends up making this tussle look a lot like Rashi's explanation of the fish case. Because you have fish who aren't smart enough to figure out where to go, but whereas if you have two stores, humans can choose. So likewise, kids are going to be drawn towards the food, but they're not going to...
Okay, so it could be. If we focus, right, depends if you focus more on the kids or more on the discrepancy between principal and agent. You make it for like the kids, so then yes, for
kids.
Can
you clarify what you mean by principal and agent?
To me, it was great. I send X to the store to buy me stuff. So X is supposed to buy the stuff for me in the way which is best for me. But now, I offer a prize to the agent, right? So really what he's saying is separating, giving out candies and things, even though they're free, and even though I don't make an explicit quid pro quo, is no different than if I appoint Elliot and I say, Elliot, please take my car and go buy gas. Right? And one of the gas stations puts up a sign saying whoever actually physically fills the gas tank gets $5. Right? So Ellie will go to a more expensive gas place because he's getting $5. So what they're doing, right, is they're introducing a distinction between my interest and Ellie's interest.
Creating a financial crisis.
Well, in the long run. Yes, in the long run, the gas company starts selling complex derivatives.
Actually,
no. But like the thing is, like, can you make the actual distinction that candies, they're an external thing, versus they're extra business? Well, I'm not sure what word to use.
So you can try and do that. I'm not sure that would be a valid distinction. Like if they said you can carry, right? If they said to you when you come to buy gas, you can carry off a quart of gas.
But that. I would say that that's closer to the business.
Right, and in my thesis, it wouldn't make a difference at all. Because my thesis is the interest is totally, the question is totally whether your interests match your agent's interest or not. And for obvious, it wouldn't matter at all because you're an adult. Right? So you have a third axis that it matters, that we just sort of conceive of whether it's part of the same transaction or not.
Mine is simpler, and I think it can be, like, it makes more sense like that.
Okay, you can sustain it. I'm not convinced, but you can see if you can sustain it. Yes, Supra Mahatma.
Maybe Rabbi Yehuda thinks that competition external to the product itself is unfair.
That's what Ellie's saying.
He did?
Yeah. Okay, yes, Joshua.
Rabbi Yehuda clearly allows competition.
Well, it depends, right? He allows competition either because he allows competition between existing businesses. It doesn't mean he allows you to enter as a competitor.
Well, someone had to enter as a competitor.
Why?
Being the case. The fact the case that there are two businesses means that there's a premise that somehow these two businesses got
into
the first place.
I set up my business in Mavoi X. You set up our business in Mavoi Y. Eventually, our stores succeed and expand, and they start attracting customers from it. Right? Our customer base melds over time. Right? We start off in different spheres, and we start melding over time. I'm not sure that you have
that's,
to.
No, that's the case that for Rav Huna, Braid Rav Yehoshua is a teiku. But for Rav Huna, we at this point in time, we assume that would be Asura.
I don't know. Same of it. I'm not at all. I'm not sure that Rav Huna can't imagine a case where there are where two people start off simultaneously.
But the Ritzba is saying that Rav Yehuda is Moda the Matsidar the Umanato.
Yes, he thinks. Because Rav Huna's case.
He's reading it as Rav Yehoshua is saying, you can open up a competing business.
Yes, they're both
and
rejecting
Rav
Huna.
Is the proof. Rav Yehuda is the proof.
Yeah, because in the end, what he wants to say is that the reason the Gemara doesn't quote this Braita is because the Gemara at this stage believes that neither position in this Braita supports Rav Huna. Right, it's just in the flow of the Gemara. Right, in the flow of the Gemara, already, all he's explaining is, why does the Gemara quote the other Braita instead of this Braita? Right now, the question then is, does he really believe this, or does he just say using this as a dichu? Right, they say, well, I have a problem. Why didn't the Gemara quote that brisa? Well, this is why the Gemara could have not quoted that brisa. Does he in fact believe the halacha in the end that that's true? I don't know, right? Because what he's just doing is explaining a stage in the Gemara. Normally, I think
explaining why of the two brisos
they picked this
one. The other one was chosen.
Yes,
not this one.
Right, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he thinks that this is the correct shot in that brisa. It just means that it's right that since the Gemara could have said that shot,
right? Because Tosfot have like a Tosfot themselves, they offer a different answer.
Mm-hmm. We'll get there. Okay. Yes, Tova.
Do you think it's significant
that he says they read the Umnatil instead of any of the other phrasing we've had.
So it seems that it seems at this point he is framing the machlokas about Rav Huna and not as to whether you can be a Reid L'Matil. Rav Huna, he is framing Rav Huna in the rejection of Rav Huna in the strongest possible terms.
Okay.
Right, that the rejection of Rav Huna means that there are no restraints, that you can do whatever you want to the other person. Yeah, I think that's true.
Okay, that's pretty crazy, right?
Crazy?
It's pretty intense.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have to make such a strong thing to make it.
No, he doesn't.
So I assume there's his equilibrium.
Yeah, I think so. I think the Rav Huna says you can say pasakti lechiyutai, and the strongest thing is so what? Right. That's the simple explanation of the rejection of Rav Huna is to say, I agree. You can say pasakti lechiyutai. So what? Right. The strongest possible way of framing it is, if you really want to take his language with ultimate seriousness, is that he holds there is fundamentally no prohibition ever against interfering with someone else's livelihood. There are no restrictions on fair competition. And our boundaries of fear are quite expansive. Okay, yes, Chaim.
The fact that the Gemara does not use this teretz for Rav Huna,
yeah,
is a match by the Gemara likes Rav Huna.
No, the Gemara. This is not a question the Gemara asks. Right, he's asking why didn't the Gemara defend Rav Huna by saying that he held that by saying now, oh, Rav Huna just holds like Rabbi Yehuda, and the answer is maybe. That wouldn't work, because we would say no, or you'd also reject Rav Huna. Right, that's right. His question is, why didn't, when the Gemara said, Lema Kitanai, why didn't you need a new Braita and not just say that the Tanai is the old Machloket? And the answer is because maybe all Mandamrim from the old Machloket don't hold like Rav Huna.
On the other hand, the original time, on the original case when we brought this Braita down, we deliberately avoided.
I mean, instead of saying Afilu Tamer Rabbanan, we could have said, no, not even he's not even Rav Yehuda. I guess we could have said that, but that wasn't the question that we were asked. We could have you're right, we could have asked it even a stronger, we could have put it up there, but it's not such a big issue with the flow of the Gemara that we don't totally reverse the question.
I'm just thinking, sometimes when the Gemara tries to bring a riot to someone, we say that the Gemara like that person and is trying to make as many.
Ah, so you want to say that the Gemara doesn't bring a riot for it. All the Gemara is defend Rav Huna against the attack. That's all the Gemara did above.
Well, no. First, the Gemara brings a riot for Rav Huna.
And then that knocks it down, and then Ravina attacks him
right,
by saying
so,
he's holding like the Meshitas Yachid, and we say, no, not really.
Right, so the Maga Mishnah will be very happy to say that, like, because we try to defend, to say Lema that Rav Huna says like this, that means that we like Rav Huna.
Well, Lema is not a like. Lema is an against. But you can say the Kevin
the
Shakli. Sometimes you'll say Kevin the Shakli Vitari Ali Vaihu. Right? We pass you like him.
Right?
We could say that. But then the problem is we don't, you know. We could say that. That might be what's behind the Bahag. We could say that. Okay, yes, Tova.
Do you think it's okay for the Shita to read the Gemara and say it's saying the opposite? Or what?
Yeah, they're not saying the opposite of the Gemara. He's saying that the Gemara could have gone one stage further. Right, Gemara, somebody said, look, Rav Huna holds like Rabbi Yehuda and not like the Chachamim. We said, no, right? No, that Braita is not a machloket on the issue. And then we could have said, and by the way, it's not even a machloket, right? Not only is it not a machloket about Rav Huna, it's not even relevant to Rav Huna. We could have said that. We didn't bother going that far because it wasn't necessary.
Let me see if I feel Rabbanan
might do. All means Rabbanan could be Moda. That's all it means. It's not a statement.
Okay.
Then we had I just wanted to give you the definitions in the read. For what goes on, that what the definition of shir chiyu taychu, so he defines it as their expenses as opposed to the capacity to make a living, and he explicitly says that the issue of making a shuk for somebody means giving them exclusive rights as opposed to giving them equal rights, and those are all issues that should play out. That should play out later. Okay, so now
Wait,
we get.
Sorry, what does it mean that shir expenses meaning?
He says, right, so they, right, these are out-of-towners, and they come in, and he says, even though normally you shouldn't be allowed to sell, I'm going to let you sell. So I could have said, I'm going to let you sell because you need to make a living. He doesn't say that. He said, I'll let you sell until you can make back the expenses that you incurred coming here.
So
is that unreasonable?
Yeah, we'll have to figure out what expenses is he talking about, right? Right, what exactly is the case, right?
Well, like anyone can show up in a...
Right,
like
so it might, so, okay. but so it has to, so it probably has to be they have to have a legitimate reason for being there.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, Jenna.
Well, we know they have a legitimate reason for being there, right? That's the whole point.
Well, they have a shrut. They have right. They have a.
But what we
outstanding loans, probably.
If it was saying like, so what you just said was the expenses that incurred coming here, meaning like business expenses that like so that they could come and collect their
yes
their debts, right? But I feel like it could also mean living expenses was something we floated. Like, you need to stay here long enough to collect your debts. You can make what you need to, like, pay for a place to stay and eat, but you can't, like, start a chain.
So I think an interesting question is whether your living expenses while you're here count as part of the business expenses. Right? I think that probably they do, right? While you're here, you have to live also.
Sure.
I think it's more expansive than that.
Sure. So, but yeah, I guess. But I think business expenses is more expansive, is I guess what I was trying to
yeah,
say.
I think business expenses is more expensive. I think, you know, if I were building a broader thing, I would think you would say is we wish to encourage interstate commerce.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we can have interstate commerce is it has to be plausible for people to collect right for people to collect debts interstate.
Right.
Right. So we have to allow people to enter right. So if in some spheres, right, basically if we want to allow if you take the position that it's loans, right? So if we want to allow international banks, then we have to allow the bankers to do business while they're here.
Right. But that's like, that gets a lot trickier to me. Like, to say, like, okay, you can, like, you don't have to, like, incur debt yourself in order to stay here is one thing, but to say, like, anything can be, maybe it's just my idea of, like, a,
so,
you know, major business these days, but anything can be incurred as a business.
I don't know how big a deal it is. I put it on the Makura because I thought that it's a definition. It's a definition that is not found in other Rishonim and that has potential to open up, right, to open up, you know, lots of spaces.
Yeah.
I don't know that we need to open the spaces yet.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So now we get to Rabbeinu Gershom. So Rabbeinu Gershom says, yes.
Can you explain why he says a sechur is shleim furu? Like, just say it, no one can tell. Like, what's the whole lashon of, like, why is he copying the Gemara lashon the word for word?
I don't know. I don't want to do that now. Good point. Okay. Hai bar mavoa mehavu mavoi, v'lo hei ragil l'kach. Right? So Rabbi Gershom says, we're in the same mavoi, and he wasn't ragil. And he sets a rechayim shalo, and he puts in a new condition that is not in the Gemara, samoch rechayim shal chavera. Now, that, right, the Gemara says, muki agabaihu, right? So it sounds like it really depends where in the mavoi. Right? Otherwise, the word samoch has no... Right, the word samach has no purpose. Right, become welcome rechayim shaloba oto amavui. That's all he does. Right, but he puts the word samach in. So we'll figure out whether that's going to be significant or not later. Right.
Okay,
yeah.
How is that different from?
Okay, so I would say, if I just had the word gabay in the Gemara, I wouldn't have been medayek from it. Right, it might just be with him in the same mavoi. But the word samach seems more powerful to me that it's. It implies the possibility that there is some place else in the same level you could do it.
How big is this level?
I don't know. I don't know. My knowledge of Mavo is almost exclusively from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It doesn't have really good proportions. Yes.
So are these handmills or are these? Okay, we don't know. They're
not, probably not water mills. Probably didn't have water mills yet, right?
It
but
could be like a donkey going around in a circle.
Could be a donkey going around in a circle. Yeah, I don't know.
It seems like there could be like. Big mills, but a
mavoi
would only support smaller
mills. I don't know. I imagine how long a mavoi is. How wide a mavoi is, I don't know. I'm pointing out the word. Okay. Marchiki mitzudas hadag min hadag. Shim hayiragil echad lefrosh mitzudato. Anybody have the faintest idea what the next word is?
Yes.
my Gemara punctuated as sechem.
Which means what?
Business.
Yeah. I thought it meant a setup. Like, see, it's some sort of something. Which is useful, but not actual.
That makes sense. The sechel should take him to mind. He does his business in the water.
I vote typo. I don't know what the typo is.
Maybe they're goods, like sechel goods.
Maybe. I vote typo.
In modern Hebrew, it's a contract.
Cool. Yes, Fan.
I have a rejected interpretation of this line that he did something to improve the water, and despite that, they gave him a reserved portion.
Right, so I thought of that too. I wish, right, it'd be really cool if I could
like
convince myself
Rabbeinu,
we're true.
That's the parish for Rabbeinu Meir
of Shaul Reuben and Tom.
Well, let's see. When we get there, let's see if that.
I don't know if that's on the source sheet though.
Let's see. But you can bring it in if I don't bring it in. I think it is. Okay, not here. Next street.
Oh, very good.
Okay, Vachavero, fine. Okay, so now we get, right, so what did Dagim do? So Dagim, as Rashi from Machlo said, Dagim, right, that the Machlo's were the fish are rabbits. That's Rashi's position. They hide in holes and you have to track them to their hole. Or the fish are ants. And they send out scouts. And if they see too many traps, then they all go back into their holes.
In the Nimuka Yosef, it's pretty clear that it's like one fish.
Well, we haven't gotten to the one big fish yet, right? Now, here
in, well, Rashi could also be one big fish. He says dog. It sounds like you're hunting a certain fish.
Yeah, Rashi rather one. I say one fish, right? Not hunting rabbits. You're hunting a mountain lion. Okay, but here, fish send out scouts, and if they see one trap, they say, all clear, only one trap. Then they swim right into it. But if they see two traps, and they all flee. Right? I have no idea what on earth Rabbi Akersham is talking about. And look, here is a methodological principle we have to care about, right? Which is, halakhically, is one of our modes of evaluating different positions, right? Right? Because often, right, many halakhic positions will depend on how you understand the fish case. So is our halakhic position based on which one we think is a more realistic portrayal of fish? Right? Is that a ground for passing?
It shouldn't matter.
Why should it matter?
I'm saying, to quote Rumnusson Slifkin, right, in his famous first controversial case, where he pointed out that elephants can't jump, right? So Tosafos might be wrong what the Gemara means about how to make a Kinyan Agbon an elephant. But the fact is, if you make an animal jump, you did a Kinyan Agbon.
Yeah, so the question is...
So, well, okay,
a better question is, what did...
In that specific case, Tosafot would make the argument from another Gemara about Shluch
Ket. I'll make a different way Slifkin argument.
The principle exists.
Right, I'll make the olive argument.
Who's
the most Slifkin? Zu Rabbi. Right, is the case very controversial because of his... Right, you don't understand. Any case.
Is it possible he just never saw...
When it comes to olives...
That's the olive argument.
When it comes to olives, right, Slifkin's argument is that... Something. All the multiplication of olive sizes came from people who never saw an olive in their life.
It's not his argument. It's a much older argument.
Ravadi made the same argument. Right? He,
but we're looking for a particularly well-written English
It's beautiful.
Case,
it's absolutely beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
You know.
So the question is...
My sister got very confused a few years ago, so I just sent it to her.
So a better statement than what we think fish actually do, which is irrelevant, is what we think the Gemara actually thought fish do, on the presumption that the author of this Breita is describing something he actually saw.
Maybe. Agreed, but it also matters what Rabbeinu Gershom says for what he says. Because this is clearly what Rabbeinu Gershom thought...
was halacha.
Yeah.
But the question is, did he think that was halacha because he got it from this braita?
I presume not. Meaning, again...
Why?
Because unless he has an assumption that this is how fish work, it just doesn't make sense. So presume...
You think he made up his idea about fish in order to match his conception of the halacha?
To the braita, yes.
The Brisa, or to his prior conception of halacha?
He has a conception of halacha. He knows the words of this Brisa. He doesn't know what fish do.
Ah, okay. So you're
just like Tosafot didn't know what elephants do.
And if you had walked over to Rabbi Gershom and you had said to him, "You're wrong. That's not what fish do. Fish do this." And since fish do this, and that's what the Brisa means, your whole theory of halacha is wrong. What would he have said?
He'd say, "No, the halacha's right. I just have shot the Brisa wrong."
What if he can't think of a shot in the bright that matches
the
halacha and matches reality?
Wait, but what if nobody can...
It would denounce you as a cook. You're denying my premise, though.
Yes.
Okay.
You want to say is that Rabbeinu Gershom is so wedded to his halachic thing that given the bright, he would have found some, and given the Brita, given the reality, he would have found some way to twist reality and the Brita together to match his prior conception of halacha.
Or he would have had said this conception of halacha comes from the males entirely and given a shot on this Brita, so that doesn't contradict his conception of halacha. Right, just like we know elephants.
No matter what.
Presume, that could be
right.
Fair.
It could be. I don't assume that.
Right, just like Tosos knows that the halacha is by making an animal jump. So I did a Kinyan Agbah, and just like Tosos knows this Gemara says something about getting elephants into the above the ground, so 2 + 2 = 5. But
it would be different if Tosos developed his conception of what a Kinyan Agbah by animals mean from a Breita which said elephants jump.
Right.
let's suppose, right, there's a braisa that says elephants jump, and you have a Tosfos that says elephants jump, what do? They bend their knees and they hop. And based on this, Tosfos says everywhere the way to do a kinyan hagbon animals is to bend their knees and jump. And the only evidence he has for this is the braisa which says you make a kinyan hagbon elephant and making them jump.
The
and they discover elephants don't have knees.
Right. If that was the case, I would be very worried about Tosfos' broad conception of.
I agree, but that's not this case, is it?
I don't know. I don't know where Rabbi Gershom got his conception from.
I think they can.
For many Rishonim, it seems like the fish are really important.
Only in terms of interpreting the Gemara, not in terms.
No,
of...
No, I don't agree.
You think they have an interpretation of the fish case, and therefore expand a concept out from that?
I think yes. I think that the fish case is a primary source for restraints on competition. Now, if you paskin like the Breita, then yeah, I think it's really a cool case. You don't have to agree with me. Yes, Elliot.
So, going back to your original question about what are we supposed to do when, you know, the halacha is based on the fish case and we think the reality of intimidation of how fish work doesn't make sense, especially, or at least doesn't make sense for that, what the Bryce is describing. What happens when that happens with all of the commentators, of all of the Rishonim? None of the Rishonim have compelling views of the fish case, though...
Yeah, Karen Tellers. So I think that's a question we have to keep facing. I mean, you know, talked about last night. What happens if the halakhic masoret is based on some kind of error? But I hope started the show last night. I usually do in other cases is that often the result of the error is more congenial to us than the because halakha tends to evolve in the direction that we find livable. So we might be very really really unhappy going back to the original halakha. So we shouldn't it's cool. And, often we find places where we don't like halakha, and we find it's cool that they it's all based on a mistake. Let's go back to the original thing. But if you do that consistently, right, the results
then
will often
you can
often
only get married once a week.
I think we need to develop a much more nuanced position. But I usually frame it as we need a strong notion of inertia.
Better.
Halakha should stay the same, unless there's a really good reason to change it. And just being wrong is probably not a good enough reason to change it.
How do you define a really good reason to change it?
Ah, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. Okay, Shashua, yes.
I think that a lot of the wide range of machloket of Rishonim in the realia about fish doesn't matter so much because they're mostly explaining what ka yahiv siyua means. Like,
yeah.
They're not really, like, that affects what the case of the fish is, but doesn't affect the essence of the fish themselves, as long as you don't challenge Rashi's basic premises.
Well, you don't challenge Rashi's.
For the purposes of us as halacha interpreters.
I am agnostic at this point about whether, right, this is along the lines of what Yesh said. I think that people will often analogize from the fish to new cases.
Yes,
and the analogy
widely.
It makes a big difference.
It's
as to
bus
what, it makes a big difference as to what you analogize it
passenger.
To. Right? Are you analogizing it to putting food someplace to entice people, or are you analogizing it to scaring fish away? Right? In Gershom, you're scaring fish away. In Russia, you're enticing them away.
Yeah.
That's a very different action.
Yes,
Yaakov. My fault. I'm still in a minute.
Yeah, I think the physics of how does it of the nets are more.
My fault. Yes, I'm jumping ahead.
I think we're underestimating fish. Right. They can
fish
they know, they can tell
you.
Like. What I'm worried about is how does the fish get into a net and then get out of the net?
Well, they're not nets. You have to study. You have to study what I think there are. I think what they are big traps, and when there are enough fish in them, somebody comes and closes the trap.
Yeah.
I think that's the, and then you lift the whole thing out of the water.
Okay.
But the trick is first to get that one fish to go there and then it comes back.
Okay. For efficiency's sake, yes, Ibrahimapa.
Why does Joshua think that having it be an interpretation of KOCR would make it less significant? That's exactly the difference between that case and the other cases, which means that it's the critical point, because everything has to be analogized to one side or the other.
I tend to agree, but we'll play this. Okay, in issues of efficiency, I'm not going to go through all the other details of Rabbeinu Gershom, just if you're interested in when we start talking about trying to make any kind of geographic distinction or whether geography is the right kind of distinction, so he has a lot of important things to say about what spaces are which. Yes, sir.
I just want to make sure, I want to give you like in the lesson that you underlined.
Yeah.
Because Lou will be dying.
Yes.
So before we discussed whether it's legal fiction or it's a substantive problem, and the fact that you didn't say, Kikas Lou be dying. So Kikas Lou be dying, it sounds like he's...
Could be. It's a very, and he thinks, and he has to, he doesn't say it's Gilo Yored Lum Nasa, right? He has a totally new analogy, right? He says that it's Zela. So that could also be powerful. If I were giving a Rosenzweig shiur, right? That would be, and this is in fact a broad, you know, lots of people have long Lumdish articles about whether Yored Lutachum Nasa was a din Gezel, or a new kind of din, right? So this would be a parade example. Of the right, you have to frame it. And actually, not only that, it's also a general machlokus in copyright law. Right, it's really kind of right. Copyright law, right? Is copyright law a theft of existing things or not? So this would be a great example. I'm not sure that I underlined it so you could see it. I'm not sure how much weight I put on it.
You're taking it too far. I'm just saying that we discussed before.
And you just want to avoid the absence of the kit. You just want to say yeah. I'm not.
It'll be a dying. It doesn't get more serious.
Yeah, I leave it to you. I leave it to you to decide how much weight you want to put on the rhetoric. Okay, we get to the riff.
Oh, by the way, do you have the consult on a future source sheet?
No.
Okay.
Okay, not yet. Anyway, so we turn to the riff. So now the riff, obviously Paskin's against Rav Huna, and he has his grounds for it. He says Rav Huna holds like Yishitas Yafid, and Rav Huna Bri Rishua is Basra. Okay, those are all perfectly standard things. The only other thing I really want to point out the riff at this stage is that he leaves out the fish and the storekeepers. And as opposed to in the Bahag, where that is not necessarily significant, because I don't know the methodology of the Bahag, in the riff it's really significant that he leaves out the right fish. Right? Yes, Tim?
Do we care that he leaves out the figs?
And he leaves out the figs, which is the Surah Mirabanan again, right?
Yeah.
Right, so again, we can have a Gemara.
That's the one about having rights to the shuk.
Yeah, that's part of the Surah Mirabanan. He leaves out halachas is related to Surah Mirabanan, and he can just say Surah Mirabanan is off screen, right? Because that's super halachic, right? It's worth figuring out. We will have to figure out later. So what, which we've already begun introducing, by terms like within Mishra Din, what, right? But you're imposing on other people that, right? What constitutes within Mishra Din?
Well, he brings in Surah Mirabanan,
no? Does he? But not the fig case.
There's no fig case.
He has written on the story.
Doesn't mean the story. He does have the line Eat Surah Mirabanan who I feel like Vuye. Right, he leaves out the second case, the fig case. Okay, worth figuring out whether that's significant or not. Good.
He also leaves out county case.
He leaves out the entire discussion before we, all right, all he does, he says, is we decide Lema Ketanoi, and he loses. Right, but he leaves out all the other Breitot, and that seems to suggest that he thinks, at that point, either those Breitot are irrelevant to the theme, or we paskin against them. That they all hold like the wrong side of the machloket.
Well, they are. If it's meant only brought a support for Rav Huna, we reject Rav Huna, then it is irrelevant.
It goes in business brought a support for Rav Huna, brought a rejection of Rav Huna, but to make him only go like one side.
Oh, but that didn't matter because that wasn't the right rejection. You have to know the methodology in the riff, how often he does that. But I think he generally leaves out the supporting braces and the non and the rejected rejecting or sometimes he leaves out the rejected rejecting braces.
I don't know. I'm not convinced. So I'll read it up, but we can like he doesn't have them here, and since he's not writing a code, it's tough to know exactly how significant it is. My take is it's more significant than you're giving it credit for.
The fish I don't think is significant at all. The other one would be significant.
Okay. I'm raising the question, you can decide for yourself or argue it out. Okay, let me get to the Rimigash. Okay, so Rimigash first of all has a new definition of Dilma Asya Lisra Shule, and he says that means right fascinating claim, right? So how did you read it? What does the Rav Migash mean about?
I'm not sure.
Don't want to tell me? Where did you read it? Jacob.
Like the first guy, if you fire him, he'll become like depressed.
He'll get depressed. Can't fire him because he'll get depressed and he'll stop learning.
Wait, what?
Imis al-kinan le, ati l'trashuli bin nafshe, v'logoris midi. He will lose all his learning. So you can't fire Torah teachers even if they're incompetent, because it's bad for them.
What?
Which is interesting.
Isn't that what it means?
Is that his
That's his explanation of the first position.
But is he saying, is he ruling that you should never fire a bad teacher?
No, because Rav Dimi says the other way around. And we probably paskin kina sofer entire b'chachma, we probably paskin the other way. But the first thought is, you can't fire people because it's bad for them. And that, by the way, is a real issue. It's a real issue. We just had a case like that. Just recognizing the trauma that being fired causes. It's one of the worst things in the world. Yes?
What's interesting here is that he takes into account not at all the quality that he gets of the educator. Explicitly doesn't take into account. Doesn't explicitly take into account the quality that the educator being provided. We are concerned only about the quality of the learning for the teachers themselves as individuals.
Yes.
Which distinguishes it from the other cases because he's the first person to bring into the discussion what's good for the consumer.
Yes, well, it may also be that he thinks that the difference between, since he's talking about people's own learning, he may think that nobody ever thought there was a difference in the quality of education. The only issue is, right, for him, the only issue in the sugya is, there are two people competing for the same job. One of them learns more than the other. We have a bias towards hiring Talmidei Chachamim. So the question is, does that bias towards hiring the greater Talmid Chacham, because we want to support learning, allow us to take the risk of lowering an existing not quite as good Talmud Chacham, and it may be that for him this whole conversation takes place solely within the economy of how to support Talmud Chachamim. Right? Mm-hmm. Maybe, although I think that it is a powerful psychological point that one has to keep in mind, really, that being fired from a job that's your livelihood is an enormously traumatic thing. We just had a case like that. A number of the rabbis of the Beit Din were just commenting, wow, this is people really need to understand because we've been fired.
So what do you do?
So I think it's really important to try as best, to handle it well, to try and ease the transition, and that's, how much of that is halakha and how much is lifting Mishuras HaDin is a really big issue. Right, this is, that's, whatever, we could have a separate shiur on severance pay, which that was one of the things I taught all year. Yes?
How do we read the Kol Shekein?
So the other guy says, no, once he's been fired, so he'll realize, oh my goodness, I'll never get a job again unless I learn more, so he'll go learn more.
What does Kol Shekein mean here?
He'll learn even more. He learned this much.
That's what Tzvi means.
I think that's what he means here. Since he's seen that they fired him, because he doesn't learn more than his friend, he'll go work and learn more than his friend.
The one who got fired.
Yeah.
Why would we be caring more about the person who got fired?
Because the guy we're hiring, so he's gonna, right, he's already learning. He's not gonna learn more or less. He's just gonna have a job. But either way, there's only one job. Either way, somebody will have it. We want, right, we as the overarching figure, our interest is to give the job in the way which will maximize Torah.
Right. So why are we talking about the guy who got fired? I think the only way you can read this is to, like, think that they're describing the person who's still there.
No. Once he's kaved the chazir b'sal kinyan lemine, since he sees that they fired him, mishum delogoris tvei kechavrei, because he did not learn as much as his friend.
Right.
The guy who got fired,
is gonna make sure he learns enough so that and more than everyone else so that he doesn't get fired.
No. The guy who got fired is gonna learn more so that he can get the other guy fired. Because once he, right, because we're basically announcing a competition. We will hire the teacher who learns the most.
When he sees that he was fired because he didn't learn as much as his friend,
he'll go and learn more until he learns until he learns more than his friend.
And then what?
And then we'll fire his friend and hire him.
But then it's
going to
be a circle.
Yep.
That's fine.
But also, like, depressed people don't
work
harder.
Pardon?
Depressed people don't work harder.
So this is a machloket, right? This is a machloket. The first person says he'll get depressed, and the second person says he'll be inspired. And you know what? Sometimes the one is right, sometimes the other one is right.
Maybe it's like the Avis theory. The person who's second best tries harder.
Yes, of course, the problem is that, the first guy... If the first guy is sadistic, he'll just keep learning just a little bit more to keep the other guy just a little bit
That's
behind.
That's still fine.
That's her principle.
No, it's cosmoeconomics. I didn't make it up.
Yes. So
it's
might
like
be.
Rational behavior.
It might be that we
all. It's all the margins.
So the second position, according to Rimi Gash, is that we at least allow class that kind of economics to function in the world of Torah. World of Torah, we have a straight way. We just want competition to maximize the growth of the Torah economy. And we will manipulate our economic resources to allow that. Right, we'll say whoever learns the most gets the job.
We're not manipulating anything.
Pardon?
We're not manipulating anything. We're either subverting
the natural tendency to fire the worst guy and hire the better, or not?
Well, we're not hiring the better teacher. We're hiring the guy who learns more to be the teacher.
Have we really distinguished them? I'm, like, still...
I think the Rimi Gosh mentions nothing about teaching.
But I think because he's assuming that whoever is learning is doing, is the same, that it's a...
And if another guy starts learning more, then all of a sudden he'll be a better teacher, by definition?
Yeah.
I don't
Is that the assumption inherent in this?
No. I don't think so. I don't think it's anywhere here.
What?
Yes, Jenna.
I just don't know. I get it for the second one. How we can say, okay, so you fire, and he's going to go learn more, and then he'll come back, he'll be better. I don't understand why the guy who gets fired getting depressed is a reason not to fire him.
Because we say right now, let's assume that all Torah workers, right, we assume are generally function at maximal production.
This is like academia.
Okay.
No, it's not about teaching. It's about publishing.
Yes. Yeah. Let's assume. Right, let's assume that that most Torah workers function at their maximum level of production.
Yeah.
So now I have a job.
Right.
So I have a choice. I can give the job to the guy who already learns more,
mm-hmm.
which might create an incentive for future people to learn more.
Right.
Right. That's the overall. On the other hand, a worker who's fired will function at less than his maximum production because he's depressed.
But we don't think the guy who doesn't get the job is going to get depressed?
No, he hasn't gotten fired. Not getting a job is not the same as getting fired. I'm not depressed today that I'm not president of the United States.
I think it's a shot. I feel like it's less of a stretch to read it as the first guy, who was it, Rava, saying keep them both. That's what I decided.
You want to say keep them both?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's hard
to read. Then no one gets depressed. Everyone's happy. Everyone's working as hard as they can.
People don't get depressed because they didn't get a job. It's not the same. Not getting a job that's already existing.
Especially if you're already around and proving yourself. It's not that he, like...
But the other guy already has the job. You don't get depressed because... To get depressed because they haven't fired someone to hire you, that's kind of extreme, isn't it?
In today's society, I assume you get depressed either way if you lose your job or if you can't find a new one.
Yeah.
If you can't find it, they can't find a new one.
Yeah,
you're just not getting this job.
Wow. Well, how do we know who's going to
And this
get
economy...
How do we go? So my beer will make a difference. This is the difference between YU when I first came to YU in the last 10 years. You know, the YU when I first came, Ralph told me that whenever there was a funeral, we kept packed to find 150 messages on his answering machine. You know, as opposed to let's hire everybody. I fear that the seven fat years are over. But my beer will make a difference, right? If there's only one job available or not, right? That could. Right, and their assumption is, look, there are always teaching jobs available somewhere. You didn't get this job, okay.
I don't think you have to assume that.
Okay, good. Now we got the same discussion as the fish case. Do you think he's psychologically plausible? And right, and how much should the psychological plausibility affect your willingness to paskin like him? Okay.
I think the fact that the Rimi Gosh doesn't mention teaching is evidence that I was right about the reading about the reading of Garis and Mikri, because clearly he doesn't think that Garis is about teaching at all.
I think you're right. I think that that the Rimi Gosh separates Garis from teaching. Whether everyone does or not, I'm not sure. But I think, and it may very well be that he does it on the same basis, since he doesn't define Mikari, we don't have any way of knowing. Okay, yes, Joshua.
So I think parallel to how Kinat Sofrim Tarbet Chokhmah is a unique Torah value,
mm-hmm.
I think the Rimi Gosh is understanding Ati Litoshule as a unique Torah value, in that he's saying that if this person undergoes the process of the Litoshule, and then he will stop learning, then he will forget all of the Torah that he has previously learned, and this is a moral Torah tragedy.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think it would put the word moral in, but
I think it's a unique Torah. I think it's a unique Torah value to try to prevent this.
Yeah, we don't.
Same way that Kinat Sofrim Tarbet Sofrim is a unique Torah value.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. We don't have. You know, if it turns out that if I fire this guy, I have two workers. One naturally produces 5 wages an hour, and one naturally produces 10. And if I fire the guy who produces 5 and favor the guy who produces 10, the guy who produces 5 will now get depressed and not produce widgets anywhere. So right. So unless I have a labor shortage in the economy, right, if there's no right, isn't it, the only reason that it would make sense is if it turns out that they're all going to get jobs. The only question is whether I fire this person and make the guy who got fired look for a job, or I don't fire this person. Then, but generally economically, you're right. Why do we care if a single worker becomes less productive? Although that's. You know, if you burn out all the workers in the economy, then at some point you have trouble. There's no such thing.
But
workers don't work no matter what.
Torah value?
Pardon?
Did you get what I meant about a unique Torah value?
Yes.
But I'm not talking about like a widget maker forgetting how to make widgets.
I know, that's my point.
Okay.
We have an interest in the... Torah learners can produce regardless of whether they have jobs. And our Torah economic interest is in making sure the most Torah is learned or known. But widgets, right? Widgets, if you fire a widget, right, there's only one job, so the total number of widgets depends on having the most productive widget makers there. What they're doing psychologically when they're not making widgets, who cares?
So the different claim is to what Kenat Sofrin Torah Chachmah means.
And Kenat Sofrin Torah Chachmah means not that it produces better teaching.
Right.
But Kenat Sofrin, look, yeah.
Better academic papers. I myself,
you know, I got into Torah first because I came from a school, you know, like most schools, where athletic success was prized, and I was not an athletic success, and I showed up in a Haredi summer camp, and they had a Mishnayot Baal Peh contest, and all of a sudden I was cool, and I was the athlete. You know, there were big, you know, as opposed to big trophies for athletes, but there was a big sign on the wall showing how many Mishnayot Baal Peh that you had learned, and you got raffle tickets, and it was much, much cooler to be the Mishnayot Baal Peh champion than it was to be the best basketball player. So I'm far be it from me to deny the virtues of competition.
So he's still making the same claim about protecting the consumer, or about aggregate. He's still trying to make the pie bigger, but he's arguing to make the pie bigger not with by competing in,
yeah, it's God's pie. Quality. Here we're increasing God's pie.
It doesn't matter. Either way, you're increasing aggregate utility, right? The point is that the normative claim. The positive claim is that...
Yeah, so the Rimi Gash, we'll see. The Rimi Gash is the proponent. We'll see, right? He says this about Torah, but even though he makes his argument in a way that... because what he does is, if he reads it in a way that isolates the Torah product of what the teacher is learning, and it basically assumes that the product of the student remains constant, which is the whole issue, right? That, you know, that in much of... You know, nowadays, we like to put out all the differentiated education stuff in Torah, but you can also find lots of statements in Torah where teaching children is a commodity, and basically anyone can do it. And there's no particular talent involved, because all you have to do is repeat stuff over and over again until they're repeated after you.
And marry the right person.
Yeah.
According to the Rimi Gash,
mm-hmm.
Does it matter that he's a teacher?
Well, so,
would the same holds apply to a Talmud Chacham with any job?
So the question is, do we give...
Or is this depression only going to be because he becomes depressed because the job
is... That's a good question. I think a reasonable argument could be made any job at which the work is a commodity, and you have two people who can do it equally well, just one of them learns more than the other, you should give the job to the bigger Talmud Chacham, assuming that having that kind of job is consistent with the dignity of a Talmud Chacham.
Right.
I think that's probably true.
But is therefore losing that job to someone because someone else comes a bigger Talmud Chacham going to lead to this machlokes that he'll either want to get his job back or he'll become depressed?
Probably.
So the fact that the case was teachers, just like Rosh Hashanah, that's what Talmud Chacham do, but it's not relevant in the slightest.
It could be.
Okay.
It very well be. Okay.
Let's read the rest of the Rigash. So he has his fish case, sorry, right, which I jumped earlier, right? The fish case is the fish has ants, as the Paramahansa said. I have no idea how you deal with this. Really don't know how you deal with this in reality. I assume that the Rimi Gash saw more fish than I did. I don't know. Okay, then he has the language, but he introduces a whole bunch of radical fiducia. So he says... that nimset otim mitzuda mafseket le lechiyute ligamre. Okay, so his understanding of the case is such that what you're doing is you are depriving the other person of everything, but it's more than that. Which he doesn't mention this case, but in his case, who gets the fish?
No one.
Now, the interesting thing is he doesn't, so far as I can tell, ever mention that the problem here is that you are helping nobody. Right? That it's purely destructive. Although that would seem to be a feature of his case, although I guess it could be that he figures that the number of fish caught in the world is constant, what you're really doing is benefiting a third party. But he should mention that, and he doesn't. Yes, Ephraim.
Maybe he thinks that the fish case is the Rabbi Strauss Lantern interpretation of Yerod Levinos Chavera.
Meaning
that nobody benefits, and that's the problem with it, which is why fish is different than anything else.
Ah. But I said, he doesn't mention it. That's my point. He doesn't mention that.
But that's what he's saying.
The case is that.
The
case is that, but he never draws the moral.
Maybe so he thinks it's obvious.
Maybe he thinks it's obvious, right?
That isn't a good contrast then with the second, with the why the Rechaim is different.
But he doesn't say it, right? He should say that, and he doesn't, right? So, right? Maybe that supports Yesh's point. He doesn't really care about the case. He's just trying to twist the case into his thing, and if he didn't do a good enough job twisting the case, so then so what?
I'm saying it has nothing to do with it.
He constructs it, right? He should say that, right? He should mention that distinction. It would be irrelevant to the Rechayim case and all that. He doesn't say it.
Right, I'm saying the reason that if it was, he was trying to back up the same Yisrael's Lander reading, then
he should have made the distinction. He doesn't. Okay. It's a weakness. It's a weakness. Yes, sir.
Maybe your luminous cover means that he has to replace, he has to take from the other guy. And being a here that no one gets it, it's not really a problem.
He doesn't make that argument either. What he says is, right, the problem in this case is that you completely erase the other person's livelihood. Then he creates a gray area because he says on the reverse case, Rechayim, you don't cut it off at all, and that leaves all the ground, that leaves all the space in the middle. But then he disambiguates. He says, the Afalgav to have a mafchis lechiyute, and here he makes this, where all of a sudden we get into theology. Right? So I cannot cut your livelihood off entirely. It's okay if I have no impact on you, and if I diminish your livelihood, then I can say to you, you know what? You get what God tells you, and I get what God gives you, and I get what God gives you. Now, that argument obviously is way too strong, because we can say that no matter what.
Right.
All right, you get what God gives you. So I, at this point, I am as bad as it is, as hard as it is to figure out his theology. Figuring out his theology is much worse. What does he mean? Yes.
I mean, I feel like he sees the type of whatever a predatory practices of someone who comes and puts their net where someone else's net is as undermining. I mean, this is problematic theologically because God can do whatever he wants, but like as prohibiting God from acting as God would normally choose to and giving people what he wants them to get. That you're, like, defying God in doing this. And that by acting morally in your business practices, then, like, you allow God to do whatever God chooses, and then you can't be blamed for...
I think morally is a very strong term, right? So let's suppose you have your fishnet here, right? What I do is, and I come and I put my fishnet in front of yours, but I leave a half-inch space so a fish can squeeze by if it really, really wants to.
Mm-hmm.
Is that acting morally?
Okay, so non-predatorily and business-wise. I mean, like, I think, I don't know.
It's going to be circular, right? Because it turns out there's no substance to his theological argument. It's just an additional factor. The real question is act morally. And then, by the way, right, how do we define it, right? If you act morally, then God gets to what he wants. If you act immorally, then God, I want a better legal definition. Right, moral.
No, I think it's like the you see it when you know when you see it.
Yeah, when you see it. No, like, I don't want that.
No, because like there's a. I don't know. I was trying to explain. I couldn't explain this in words either. That like there's like an act where you're like just competing with someone, and then there's a point at which you.
So I need a legal line.
Yeah.
I need a legal line.
I'll work on it.
Is Shemaiah the invisible hand of the market?
Pardon?
Is Shemaiah the invisible hand of the market?
Yes, Joshua.
So I thought that the sources that both invoke God as a way to like obviate the negative effects of competition.
Yeah.
Also, somewhat coincidentally, seem to be the sources that have the most consumer protections and the fewest protections on sellers. So indeed, it might be that the hand of God is an invisible hand.
Okay. I don't understand what the invisible hand seems to have limits to its powers, though. Right?
Oh,
you can set up force fields that stop Apollo's hands. No Star Trek, no Trekkies here at all.
That episode.
It's a terrible episode.
I thought.
Yes, let me know. Yes.
I think it would be a mistake to view this as some sort of extremely hard determinism, occasionalism, or something along those lines, where, like, God can do whatever he wants, so, like, you know, why are you hitting yourself, sort of argument. Because I think what's going on is that it's some sort of limited determinism where there's a mechanism by which God distributes livelihood to the world, and that mechanism can be interfered with. So the concept is that if you if you totally cut off the divine plumbing system with the channels of positive energy coming down, so like nothing's gonna work.
I don't think we're making anything better.
But I'm just trying to be descriptive here. What I think.
If we want to be really strongly descriptive, we'll say as follows. What he says is that that the only time God comes into play is when it is when it's something that otherwise appears random. So if I create an environment where the fish can choose randomly, so then it's all up to God. And if God wanted me to get nothing, I would get nothing, and you would get everything, right? So, but any time that I bias the odds, right? So that, right. So God, right? Then it would require a miracle, right? And
like I'll put it this way: like if I send you a letter, like you're gonna get the letter, but somebody could still interfere the letter. Doesn't mean I didn't send you a letter.
So God has a default. Setting for the world, and we have to try and act.
And the idea is not to.
Okay,
that.
No more theology. Because
okay.
It's not. I think you have to keep this in mind because this idea will show up repeatedly in later commentaries. It really will. And I don't know how they do this theologically. This is not a theological point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. He's not making a theological claim, right? He's
right.
Saying the fish constitute, again, like Rashi, the fish constitute a physical taking.
Uh-huh.
This does not necessarily constitute a physical taking. And as long as we're not necessarily constituting a physical taking.
This is a physical taking.
No.
The fish is a physical taking.
The fish is a physical taking. As long as we're not necessarily.
The grindstone is not.
Yeah. As long as we're not necessarily constituting a physical taking, we cannot prevent competition.
Okay, you're right. There's no theology, but doesn't fit the. You're not paying attention to the fact that he uses theological language.
The language is just to say.
Okay.
Whatever happens.
So we have a first choice, right? We can say, you know what? He's only saying what people will say, and sometimes, right, from people will say things like it was Bashir.
Yeah.
Right. And it was Bashir. It doesn't have historical significance. Doesn't have deep significance. Bashir just means, right? You know what happens, as you say, que sera, sera.
It's not that it's like just link. It's just like that's the way we say randomness. If you don't.
Limit right. Okay. It's just
randomness.
Right. Because what we're from, we don't say random. We don't say it was random. We say it was Bashir.
How else would 12th century Spain have said that it's not in our hands?
Derech HaTeva.
Is that the phrase that he would have used?
I don't know.
I'm sure he knew.
Okay, so I'm going to cut this off now, and I think that a question we all have to decide, and then decide how you evaluate it, is do you think that he is articulating something that has to make sense, at least in terms of popular theology, or is it essentially just a cover for a rhetorical device covering up, right, putting a religious spin on randomness?
He's quoting a Gemara, no? That's a quote
yes.
From
Gemara. Quoting a number of Gemara is about pronouns, though. Gemara about pronouns are not so easy to systematize theologically either.
Isn't the Hemshchah Gemara he's quoting say that, like, except for if someone steals from you? So now the theological point is all that. Now
it's
the point
just
is.
Boils it down to theft.
Yeah, does this constitute from a. Not necessarily from a legal perspective, from a heavenly perspective, theft of what was designed for this person? Isn't that the
Hemshchah Gemara? I don't know. The Gemara, yeah. Natan lechol basar dachlam b'ito. You have Gemara about that also. I don't pretend to understand how the Gemara constructs or how seriously it's taking it. I leave it to you. Okay. Going on. Right, this so far is interpreting the Gemara. Now, the next thing that we may have to do is completely introduce something that is not in the Gemara at all, so far as I can tell. But he, let's say it was a prophetic inspiration from Tova. Ella, miu mistabrilan, dehani mili kulu heka deleka pseida alakukimhi. All the restraints and competition that we gave in the net, right, in the narrowest possible case, none of them apply when there is no loss for the buyers. And we're all talking about a case, the shavu dami mahadari, the shavu iski nami hadari. We're dealing with roughly identical prices and identical merchandise.
Merchandise,
even?
First?
Is
merchandise?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think so.
Hold on. Can you just translate that again?
Yeah. It seems reasonable to us. Dehani mili kul, all the prior discussions about possible restraints and competition are only hecha de leka pseida alokimhu. That's only in the cases where there's no loss for the buyers. As, for example, where they have the same money, the shavu dam nadari, the prices are the same, the shavu niski nami hadari, and the merchandise is the same. So that the buyers will gain nothing by the introduction of the competitor. So under those circumstances, he says, avdi rabbanan takantu l'vnei masa, in those cases, the rabbis legislated a protection for the people of a particular geographic space. Kihechi v'lishayan iskayhu v'latafsik lehu l'chiyutayhu, so that their businesses should not slow down. Right, it should not take them longer to sell the same. I think that's what lishayan means. Right, because if you introduce competitors, then there will be more goods on the market, and that will take them, it will take every individual merchandise longer to sell. So their income stream per day will slow down. The latafsik lehu l'chiyutayhu, right? So you are interrupting their living. But if the merchandise is the same but the prices are different, or the prices are the same but the merchandise is different, we see. If the buyers for this merchandise are not Jewish, they're not part of our economic group, so then you can still prevent competition. Because the gain will not be part of the economic system that we are concerned with. But
so you can or you can't prevent
competition? You can. Right? If the gain, right? If competition would lower prices or increase quality, but the benefits of that are the right are buyers who are not part of our economic system, they're not Jewish. Right? So we have no interest in regulating that. But if the buyers in this particular place are Jewish, it seems reasonable that we do not have the authority, it's a very strong language, we do not have the authority to make regulations that will benefit one segment of our constituency over another segment of our constituency. Because the total economically is the same. Right, we're treating it as a zero-sum game, the same amount of money. Right, if all the producers or consumers are Jewish, and there is no external outlet for the money, so then it's a zero-sum game. So we can benefit the sellers by preventing competition, or we can benefit the buyers by introducing competition. Right, we're not going to make a choice among them. Is that clear? I'm going to try it one more time. Okay, let's put right. There is in this, we all know that everybody has three. We all know that in this town there are going to be ten widgets bought this year. Okay, right? And in this town there are, right? In this town there are widget sellers. And the widget sellers are selling widgets at $1 each. Okay, so ten buyers in the city are going to have to spend $1 each on widgets this year as it goes. Now an external widget maker comes in, and he's willing to sell widgets. He's willing to sell widgets for 90 cents. So that will mean that will save 10 cents for each widget buyer in the area. But you know what we're going to assume is no. Really, what's going to happen is that the local widget makers will lower their prices. So what's going to end up is either the local widget makers get $1 less, or the local widget buyers have $1 more. If that's the issue, now there are economic things you have to work out here, right? Maybe they'll sell fewer widgets, right? Right? Not just have to lower prices, but the introduction of competition means they'll sell fewer widgets. So we have to work out exactly how they're defining the market. But the way the Rimi Gash sets it up initially is if our choice as regulators is, right, is that there's money that can either be in the hands, it's all local, and there's money that can either be in the hands of the consumer segment or the producer segment, or the buyer segment or the seller segment, we will not legislate to have the interest of one community or another. We're going to avoid class warfare. We won't regulate. And the default in the absence of regulation is that we allow competition.
That's a claim also.
Yes. That is his claim. The default is not to regulate. Yes.
So, two things. One, I think Yaakov pointed out pretty well. I don't think it's a default and that we go back to the default. He says we favor the low theme. And secondly, I think you are imposing an idea of competition in free market economics that's not actually in the Rimi Gash. He just says if there are outside people who sell for less, you can let them in. Not that by letting outside people who sell for less come in, the local merchants will also
charge less.
He doesn't tell. Okay, so let's play. He doesn't tell you. Let's.
And that's the Nimukayose. It's challenge to him that this doesn't work actually for free markets. I don't think he assumes free markets. I think he just assumes outsiders charging less, better for the lochim. Therefore, it's okay.
Okay, so you have two critiques. One is that I started trying to model the response of the local sellers to competition at lower prices, and he never explicitly does that. The second thing is that if there is a gain for the buyers, so you think that the way to read it is that we will always benefit the consumer, but when it comes to a choice, we will not legislate to benefit the sellers over the consumers.
Yeah. We do not legislate to benefit the sellers over the consumers. We only legislate when there's only a loss for the sellers.
So we prefer consumers over sellers, but not vice versa. Right? It's really a straightforward equation. We always prefer the interests of consumers over sellers.
Yes.
And not vice versa. Okay, that's it. That's certainly possible.
Probably because there are usually more consumers than sellers.
The claim. The claim is this is a buyer's market or whatever.
Well, the only time we don't do that is when the buyers are non-Jews.
Yeah.
Right. We would make a takana for the most. I see. So as we will make a takana for the mokrin to keep out competition. So the answer is our first priority is buyers. So we will legislate to help the buyers even if that hurts the sellers.
Yes.
And then we will legislate to help the sellers if it hurts outside sellers, but not if it hurts local buyers. Because we are willing to legislate,
yes.
Right.
So as long as it does not hurt local buyers, you can legislate against outsiders.
So we have a hierarchy of interests.
Yes.
Hertz. Sellers, buyers, outsiders.
And Hertz is
buyers, sellers, outsiders.
Hertz is considered relative, right? Because if the outsiders are going to have just like a tiny difference in price, so he's not going to let the outsiders in. Because the way
that's the name of that.
He mentioned that also, right? He says a lot.
What? I did not see that yet. I thought that was only in the challenge
to him. So let's go right. So it's a hilchah. Therefore, he says, since there would be a benefit to buyers if you allow an outside competitor, lav kol kiminahir demokrim demetakli nafshayu mafsi de lechrim. So then the sellers do not have the capacity to help themselves at the expense of the buyers. So that sounds like the formulation is less strongly your way.
Say one more time.
Yes.
Right here he says, so if letting an outside competition is going to help the sellers, but harm the buyers, the sellers do not have the right to legislate for the mitakli nashayu to help themselves at the law, right, at the cost to others.
Others meaning outside
sellers. Others meaning buyers.
Outside.
Right. The sellers are not entitled to demand protectionist legislation if that will have a cost for buyers.
Okay. So you're saying the sellers do not demand goes to a default setting.
Yeah, so it sounds like the default setting is that we allow competition.
Because it's better for buyers.
No. The default setting is we allow competition because competition is legal.
But I feel like
emphasis is on the fact that the buyers are getting.
And then, but we have the option of regulating to prevent competition. But the problem is he frames it both ways, because in one case he seems to think that we're making a takana. Right? That's really the core issue. Right? Is it that normally the buyers should be protected, but we make legislation to when it will benefit? So normally the sellers would be protected. We make legislation to benefit buyers, or is it normally there should be free competition, but we make legislation to protect sellers?
I just don't know if the word competition. I think competition makes us think of free markets, and that's a bad way to look at it. I think it's lower prices, therefore you can let them in. Not lower prices, or you can't let them in because you have local sellers. But what we care most about is the lowest price. For the buyers.
That's right, but we care about something else because even when there's no effect on prices, we will protect local sellers.
Right.
Which goes back to the hierarchy.
Which goes back to the hierarchy and not a default setting.
You don't think so? You're right that the data can be explained without a default setting. And his language, that's why it goes both ways. Because takana sounds like a change from the default.
Right. I guess to me, when you say default setting, I think your language presupposes this idea of free market.
Well,
I don't think
the nafkamina is what happens if we get a teku.
If the people coming in are selling for anything less than what people are here.
What happens? We have uncertainty about whether it'll affect prices, right? So we, right.
if we have uncertainty about whether it will affect prices, but as it is, they're charging more, you don't let them in.
I don't know. It depends on what your default setting is.
But I think the Rimigash is... I think the Nemu Kiyosif has a good challenge on the Rimigash, and I think it has a good reading of the Rimigash, which would mean that if we don't know what's going to happen to the prices, but as it stands now, the prices will stay the same.
Okay.
You don't let them in.
So we'll get that to the Nemu Kiyosif. Okay, we're all going to drop if we don't finish this, so let's at least finish the Rimigash. So Chani says, Bar Masa, Chrisei Matzi, right, Matzi L'Akev. Right, so now he's on the next line, right? So up till now he's been explaining the line. Right now, up till now he's been going through the sugya as a whole.
Fish.
It sounds like
the fish. That's what I don't get. How does he get this all?
You think
from
he's,
the
this
fish?
Is all from the fish? No, he quoted the Masa Dahanu Dikuloy and the Masa
Amarei.
Right.
Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
So he says. So what he's saying is Isul Rishusa Libnei Masa Le'akuve the Lo Le'asui Iskei Masa Achrisei. So one Masa can prevent people from the outside. That's the assumption so far. But then he says, Bar Masa, Achrisa, Masim Akev. So I don't know where he has, I don't know exactly how he's reading the Gemara. Is this the same one next? He says, Hecha Deleka Harvacha Tare. Dehao Midim Demazbin Behu. Well, Hecha Nika Arvacha Tare. Bo Matsim Akev. The low Kol Kimidim Matkil Nashay Masi Kol Benimase. Vechain Das Nodis. Is this the same thing over again?
Yeah.
Or is he saying something new? So it was just one was like a tshuva and one was like a parish?
Yes.
And we only have one manuscript, so it's hard to track. Okay, so we have to hold that it's hard to figure out exactly what the relation of the parts is, and we'll see later, right, that there's a quote from him that says nothing like either of these. Alright, so we get to the Megiosif where he seems to have a different version entirely. Maybe it's worth just, we're gonna collapse. So let's say we'll end here. What I would like to do is to start share. All of you are through the packet of Rishonim?
Almost.
Not quite.
Okay. So let's say that we start share at 10 tomorrow morning, with the ambition of by 12:15, being through the packet, and I will probably just means it means I'll have to take a lot fewer questions tomorrow. But I think we have to be through this by the end of the week. And you've done a beautiful, beautiful job of teasing out all the implications and the broad conceptual issues so far. So I think we can probably afford to go through it, pointing out what the potential of the Rishonim remaining is. And then I'll give out the, and all these issues will be revisited again anyway, because we haven't hit the Tosafists yet, and the Tom's Panzers are coming. So that's right. So we'll start here at 10 a.m. tomorrow. We'll hopefully finish here around noon. As I say, I have a dentist appointment in Newton, so there is an endpoint. And the idea is, I'm hoping that even if we have to skip some things, that we'll get through the highlights of the packet, and we can talk about what the details are later. But we do have to, at the end, you know, we do have to. I'm confident, because really the discussions have been terrific. I'm confident that we'll be capable of understanding the later things that depend on it, and you'll have to go back and look at and find out which things were most significant as we go on. Okay.
So we're getting a new packet.
Can I ask?
A new packet after shear tomorrow.
Would people like another Hazara shear on Monday?
Or Thursday afternoon. I was going to go Thursday afternoon.
Yeah.